Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer and author Eleanor Henderson. Henderson was born in Greece, grew up in Florida, and received her MFA in fiction from the University of Virginia. Her debut novel, 10,000 Saints, was named one of the 10 best books of 2011 by the New York Times, and in 2015 was made into a feature film starring Ethan Hawke. Her second novel in what we'll be discussing today is The 12 Miles Straight, a gorgeously written, epic American tale of rural Georgia in the 1930s during the Great Depression, Prohibition, and Jim Crow. The 12 Miles Straight was published last month by Echo Books, an imprint of HarperCollins. Henderson is an associate professor in the writing department of Ithaca College. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Tish.
Yes, it was such a pleasure to read your new book. Now, I want to begin with the beginning. You say the 12 Miles Straight had been simmering in you based on stories that your father told you about his childhood as a white sharecropper in Georgia. So tell us about that.
Yeah, my father grew up on a road called the 10-Mile Straight, actually, in Ben Hill County, Georgia. He was born there in 1932 to a family of sharecroppers and small business owners and who were just getting by during the Depression. And I grew up hearing stories about growing up on the farm. He grew up picking cotton and shaking peanuts and keeping the farm going when he was a boy with seven siblings who were doing the same. And I was always really drawn to those stories because they seemed to be about such a distant time and place. It was hard to imagine what life would be like on the farm. And so I sort of stored those stories away, and I thought that I would have a Georgia book in me sometime. You know, this book is so different from my first book, but I really had, you know, grown up reading stories of the South. That was really my first love. And so I thought that I would come back to that material, but I didn't really know what the story would be. I just knew that it was a landscape that still spoke to me.
Yeah. Oh, it's an absolutely gorgeous book. And to tell us a little bit about the lead character, Elma. She's really a fascinating character, and she's sort of the eyes of the book. To tell us a little bit about her and the family.
Sure. So the central family in the book is the Jessup family, and Elma is this young daughter of this white sharecropper named Juke, and she's 18 when the book begins. And she is sort of the central character, if there is one, I think. The book roves among many points of view, but I think hers is probably the most dominant and probably not coincidentally, probably the one that is most most like my own. And so she begins the story with a couple of violent acts in the first, one of them quite violent, at the beginning of the story that propel us into the novel. And the first is that she gives birth to a couple of twins. This is, you know, first page of the book. And one of them is light-skinned and one of them is dark-skinned. And so immediately her father, Juke, and her fiancé, Freddie, accuse the closest field hand, Genus Jackson, who lives in a shack on the farm, of raping her. And so early in the novel, Juke and Freddie present Genus to her and ask her, is this the man? And she nods. She sort of tacitly gives her permission to these two men to kill him. And so the book is really a reckoning with the birth of the twins and then the murder of this man as Elma.
And the truth, too. Yeah. I mean, the truth that finally comes out about all these characters,
yeah,
which is fascinatingly woven and full of secrets. And
thanks. Yeah. So at first, there's this sort of narrative that the town creates and that the family creates around the paternity of these babies. The town is skeptical, but also fascinated, and you know, they call the birth a miracle and a disgrace. And so Elma has to then go forward and raise these twins with the help of Nan, who's the young black housekeeper, who's like a sister to Elma, who's grown up on the farm with her since Nan was born. And so these women have to care for these two children with this father figure, Juke, who is sort of domineering over them throughout the novel.
Yeah. And he's oppressed, too, because he's really the caretaker of a very rich man's farm. He doesn't really own the farm.
Yeah, I was really interested in the system of sharecropping and all of the ways that power could be exploited within it. And I was particularly interested in trying to recreate a kind of similar structure that my father described growing up in. And, you know, I'd always thought of sharecropping as being, you know, a very exploitive system. But, you know, I think that it probably exploited people in different ways and certainly across racial lines in different ways. And so, you know, my father was a member of the only family that sharecropped on his farm. And so they rented the house from this family, and they were sort of responsible for hiring out the field hands who could come and go. And so Juke kind of occupies a similar status, sort of intermediary status, where he has access to this incredible wealth and power because he is in the quote-unquote big house. They live in the big house on the farm, and he also is in bootlegging business with the landlord. And so he really craves that power, but he also, you know, he grew up in the shack that Janus Jackson lived in. So the memory of being the poorest and the neediest in the community isn't very far from him either.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I was really fascinated by the house girl, if you will. I guess we call her that. Mm-hmm. Nan. She's what, 13 years old or something when the novel begins, and she can't speak. Mm-hmm. But she is such a vivid character. How did you do that?
Well, I think sometimes when we give ourselves limitations as writers, we have to sort of, you know, mine for whatever is available, whatever material is available. And in kind of limiting my access to Nan, you know, as a character, she couldn't speak what she wanted. She couldn't perform as a character in that way. You know, I really was forced inside to explore her interior life, which was something I didn't do without some trepidation. But I really wanted to make sure that she had a vivid interior life. And even though she is incredibly powerless in many ways in her life, she's this young black orphan who can't speak, and she's incredibly poor, and she lives in this house with these white people who love her in some ways, but don't treat her well, to put it mildly, in other ways. And I wanted to make sure that she did have some voice and some power. So she does know how to read, which is a secret that she keeps from Juke.
Yeah.
Alma has taught her to read when she's young. And so that is a kind of instrument of power that she wields. And she also is a midwife. Her mother, Ketty, who died when she was 12, has taught her how to bring babies into the world, which is a pretty powerful thing. So I tried to use those devices, if you will, to try to give her life and give her power.
Oh, it worked. It absolutely worked. And you also intimate, and it comes out in the book that Nan and Elma are really like sisters. I mean, they really feel like they're sisters. They're oppressed by the men and so on.
Yeah.
But they do have a pretty loving relationship in a way, you know, in regard to the different levels of cultural, you know.
Yeah, there's so much that they have in common. I mean, their whole world is this farm, and they each are, you know, orphans of a kind. Alma's mother has died when she's young. Nan's father has left when she was young, and now her mother has died. And so they really depend upon each other, especially when they are living alone in this house with Juke, who is, you know, manipulating both of them in various ways. And so they are, you know, their allies. And I really was interested in thinking, you know, about our contemporary notion of allyship and what that means for Elma to be an ally to Nan. You know, how can she help her, this young black woman who she speaks for, to, you know, assert her own power, to keep her safe? And
Elma fails.
Elma
at
fails.
That, pretty much.
Many times.
And the way you portray her denial about what's happening to Nan is absolutely, absolutely brilliant, I think.
Thanks. Well, yeah, I think that it was important for me to, you know, to create these characters as individuals on the page, but also to think more largely about, you know, how we as white women in particular live in a state of denial. You know, what is our responsibility to black women's stories, and how do we use the power that we have, which sometimes when we're living in a house with another man is not very great. But yeah, she fails a lot. You know, she tries to speak for Nan when they're, you know, at the doctor's office, for example. You know, she isn't feeling well. She has a fever. And sometimes she, you know, in an intuitive way of siblings, you know, can guess what Nan is thinking and feeling, but often she doesn't know what's in her heart. And so she falls short, you know. And That was important for me as a white writer writing about and from the point of view of some black characters, too, to explore my own anxieties about writing from the perspective of an other, because I inevitably would fall short in doing that, too.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, too, because, I mean, that process of doing research, you had to do research about what was happening to the black community. It's controversial to undertake. Mm-hmm. Portraying black characters as a young white woman, of course. And so how did you get over that? And did you do different kinds of research? Because did your father talk about the racism and the levels of
he really
treatment?
Didn't talk about it, and that was one of the things that really influenced me early on. You know, that when I realized, you know, that there were stories that weren't being told in my family that had been, you know, repressed or that my family wasn't aware of. And I really wanted to sort of fill those holes. And so, for example, when I was doing research early on about lynching in South Georgia, especially in the year 1930, it was such an astounding year in that between 1927 and 1929, there were no lynchings in the state of Georgia, no recorded lynchings anyway. And then in 1930, there were six. And the first one in January of 1930 took place 10 miles from where my father grew up, 2 years before he was born.
Wow.
And it was an astounding, horrific lynching that involved about 1,000 white people who made up this mob who killed this young black man. And so as soon as I discovered that, I called my dad and said, oh my gosh, I had never heard of this. Tell me about it. And he said, I have no idea. And so that kind of silence around those giant historic events really led me to explore, you know, what those narratives would have been. And so, you know, like a book like The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson was really helpful in really providing a kind of national level examination of black life and the beginning and middle part of the 20th century. But then another work that was really helpful to me in doing that research was some papers by a woman named Viola Andrews, who was a black sharecropper on a farm in the 1930s who was married to a white man whom she hated.
Oh.
And so, you know, those kinds of first-person narratives, whenever I could seek them out, were really helpful. But I think no matter how much sort of research you do, it's always going to fall short in some way, and there always is going to be a gap that the imagination has to fill in. And so that gap was always really scary to me. And I don't know that I ever got over the anxiety about, you know, what that gap represented, but I did enter that task knowing that it was going to be risky. And I think writing should feel that way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it works, too, because, I mean, in some ways you're reporting history. In this, it's a historical fiction. You know what struck me too? Slavery was supposedly gone by then, but obviously this Nan and some of the black characters in these books are slaves to the lives that they're forced to
right.
live.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was another reason why sharecropping was so interesting to me, because it really is just this natural progression from slavery, you know, not that many decades before. You know, the men on the chain gangs, too, you know, were essentially living extremely limited and harsh lives. And that was another thing that my father said when he did my reading, you know, when he read this book, was, you know, those guys on the chain gang, they were, it wasn't so bad, you know, so I had to constantly reconcile those narratives.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eleanor Henderson. We're talking about her new novel, The 12 Mile Strait. It's a gorgeously written epic. It's about Georgia in 1930 and a farm family and racism and prohibition. It's got everything in it. It's really quite an amazing novel. Now, I was wondering about this, too, because you go so deeply into your novels. I've obviously read the first one. We talked about that one. Do you sometimes feel like you're living in two different worlds? You must have to be by yourself with these people and live the life with them. Are you talking to them? And how do you do that? Because I know you have a husband and kids. And
Yeah, it does seem like I'm living two lives sometimes, you know, that I'll enter into a world for a few hours in a day and then have to come back up and resurface and enter the real world again. You know, I think that kind of code switching becomes a little bit easier when it becomes routine. But it was strange to go to this place that was so distant and so specific and dark, and then reemerge and, you know, pick up the kids from school and go about my day. But, you know, I think that's the reason why I write books, because I want to live in as many worlds as I can.
Yeah, yeah. Did you actually do research with Black historians and Black scholars to talk about the way Black people were treated in 1930 Georgia?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I didn't really do a lot of personal interviews or oral histories in general. Mm. You know, most of the work that I did was either, you know, a book and library research or research that took place during three trips that I took to Georgia. And so it was important for me to see the land. And, you know, I read a lot of oral histories and read a lot of first-person narratives. Most of the people, you know, whose work I'm reading, whose voices I'm reading have died. And so we really was trying to recapture those old voices. But the land is still much the same. And so I took three trips back to Georgia, and one of them involved going with my dad back to that that land and seeing it with my own eyes and you know, just trying to capture that sense of the landscape that I love so much, you know, but that contained a lot of dark history.
Yeah. Was your dad ever worried about the stuff that you might uncover when you were looking into this, since he didn't remember lynchings and so on? Was it freak time for him to find out about some of the history of his neighborhood?
No, I don't think that he was concerned about that. You know, I don't think that he felt that he had any secrets to hide or that there were any lingering around. And I think he, you know, would have accepted them. But, you know, I think that he's 85 now. And, mm-hmm. and he was, you know, 5 years old when he lived on the farm. And I think his reality was limited. It was narrow. It was limited to this farm and to, you know, the Black neighbors and so on. But it was, you know, so informed by that period that I think, you know, he's a very liberal guy who voted for Bernie, you know, but at the same time, you know, he was a Georgia kid through and through.
And we do forget that it was a different time, you know. I mean, now everybody knows everything that's happening across the world because they didn't have people delivering news into their living rooms every night.
Yeah, like, and that was one of the things that really engaged me when I started writing the book, was just imagining my father, who was about 80 when I started, who had just gotten an iPhone. And, you know, he used to ride in a mule-drawn cart to church, you know, and what a lifespan he lived and, you know, how much change took place during that lifetime. And so it was a real gift to me as I was writing the book to be able to communicate with him about the daily patterns of his life and how he lived on the farm. And so I did want to capture that somewhat romantic notion of rural life while also complicating it in ways that, you know, his childhood self couldn't.
Yeah. And then we all know that rural life wasn't so romantic.
Right.
I mean, we even had
right.
Walker Evans's photos from that era that we all saw.
Which were
Let Us
also
Now
really
Praise Famous Men, those books, mm-hmm. yeah. You know, the Jim Crow era obviously was a disgraceful time in our country's history. But a lot of the reviews and so on say that there are parallels for today with your book. Can you talk to me about how you feel about that? And do you think that's true as well?
I do think that's true now. I wasn't quite aware of that when I first started writing the book. Mm-hmm. I think I was pretty ignorant about how relevant the book would be. And, you know, certainly over the last 6 years, the political climate has changed so dramatically that it's quite difficult now to deny how severe our race relations really still are, how severely they're still broken. So as I was writing the book, I realized, you know, how close the Civil War really still is.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
still right there in the backyard. And so many of the wounds that I was exploring in the book, the wounds of these poor white characters, you know, I think are still formed very freshly by the loss that they experienced in the Civil War. And so today, you know, it's not that difficult, I think, to draw the line back to that division. The epigraph for the book comes from Genesis. And it's two nations are in thy womb. And when I read that, I thought about, you know, the black, our black nation and our white nation. But really, I think we could also say, you know, the nation of the North and the nation of the South. You know, we still are very much divided in that way.
Oh, yes. And we're seeing it every day on the news. I can feel the ghosts of social justice crying out from mm-hmm. that time going, mm-hmm. you still haven't done it. Mm-hmm. You still haven't mm-hmm. come over the hurdle. And your book reminded me of that, how far we haven't come.
Yeah.
Which is amazing to me.
Yeah. I it's a sort of painful revelation, you know, to know that a book that I worried wouldn't be relevant enough is actually, I think, speaking to this moment. And I hoped, you know, as I continued working on it, that it would be that it would tell us something about the way that we're living today. But I didn't expect it to come into the world a few weeks after Charlottesville, for example,
yeah.
a time when we're using the word lynching really not very figuratively.
Yeah.
And
we're dealing with Civil War heroes and tearing down
exactly,
statues,
yeah.
and it's absolutely relevant. Well, was there anything that totally surprised you when you were doing some of your research, especially about that era that you hadn't known about?
One of the things that surprised me the most that I spoke about was the lynching. I've already spoken a little bit about that, but I think that was the thing that really was the most appalling to me, was looking at the histories of lynching and, you know, obviously how pervasive it was and how accepted it was among
yeah, people would bring their picnic baskets.
Right.
It's absolutely
yeah.
disgraceful when,
yeah.
I think, when you think about what was really happening. People turned it into a party.
Yeah, and you know, to pictures and everything else, but I think the way that lynchings sort of ebbed and flowed was I still scratch my head a little bit about that. And you know, when I was doing research at the Georgia Historical Society in Savannah, I was going through the microfilm and came across a headline that came right at the end of 1929. So this is 3 years into the sort of dry spell. And the headline in this Georgia newspaper was "Lynching to be a Lost Art."
Oh my God!
So even in this sort of, you know, triumph of finally, you know, conquering the evil of lynching, there's still this weird sort of nostalgia for it or something. You know, strange phrase. And then, you know, as you crank the microfilm forward, you see just a few weeks later that horrific lynching that I mentioned in Osceola, Georgia, And so that was one of the questions that really propelled me into the book. What happened in 1930 that violence reared its head in such an emphatic way? You
yeah.
know, what were the economic influences of the Depression that I think, you know, forced many of those white farmers, in the case of this book, to, you know, lash out at those who had less power than they did?
Yeah, yeah. It could have been demagogic leaders like we're witnessing nowadays. We're coming full circle with people feeling like they have a license
yeah,
to
and
behave
sure.
like mobs.
Sure, and a lot of the politicians of the age were proud members of the KKK.
Yeah.
You know, the Georgia governor around this time was in the Klan, and so, you know, wasn't in the closet.
Yeah, yeah. Now, amid all these fictional characters, you did have FDR in this book, which I thought was really interesting to see him. And so then I started thinking, this is a historical novel. This isn't just fiction. This is historical. Are any of the other characters based on real people?
So FDR is the only real person mm-hmm. who's in the book, but there is another figure who is based sort of loosely. Actually, two characters are probably based loosely around this other character. Q.L. Boothby, who is the newspaperman. He is the editor of a newspaper called the Macon Testament in the novel. There's a real newspaper called the Macon Telegraph. And I was really interested in the editor of that book, of that newspaper, the Macon Telegraph, W.T. Anderson, because he was one of the few voices in Georgia newspapers who was really condemning lynching. And that was, you know, one of the places where you were seeing some common sense being forwarded to the public. And I was interested in, you know, what does it mean to be a sort of liberal advocate for racial justice in Georgia in 1930? And so Q.L. Boothby is formed around him to some degree. And then there's also another journalist who I became very interested in from the Macon Telegraph, and his name is Aaron Burned. And I read a great deal of his papers at the Emory Library when I was there for a week. I became sort of obsessed with this sort of liberal progressive. And there's another man in the book, Oliver, who eventually marries Alma, who is this white man who is trying to do right by the twins and by Alma and by this young black woman. And, you know, he sort of is the white savior of the book. You know, he sort of fashions himself as, you know, the man who's going to come in and help these poor people. And, you know, that was important for me, too, to sort of, you know, think about a character who would have been, you know, quite heroic to readers, but at the same time, you know, deeply limited in the way he saw his own role in relationship to these other people.
Mm-hmm. What would you say in just a few sentences to get somebody to read this book? It's a very long book. It's densely filled with totally fleshed out characters. It's wonderful, but you know how people don't read nowadays,
and oh, really?
History scares people.
Yeah, I think, you know, this isn't necessarily a book that I would pick up right away because it would seem pretty dark, you know, but I think that a good book shouldn't make you feel comfortable, and it's okay for a reader to feel uncomfortable. It's okay for us. In fact, I think everybody should be reading something that is upsetting, provocative, and, you know, that makes us uneasy in a way that can be productive.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we only have a couple minutes left. How do you receive reviews, good and bad? Does that affect you as a writer?
Yeah, it does. I'm still working on that. You know, I sometimes want to put my head in the sand, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I remind myself that I want to be part of a conversation. While I was writing the book, I had a quote above my desk from Flannery O'Connor, who said, "I don't worry that the book will be controversial. I worry that it will be uncontroversial." And so if people are disagreeing with my book, or they find that it falls short in some ways, you know, I think that can be a good thing. You know, I think that I want to fill that space in with a conversation about how we can, you know, be better as writers, be better as citizens, and you can stick your head in the sand for a little while, but you got to pick it back up.
I just want people to read books, and, you know, and then you can write a review, and whatever you want to say is fine.
Yeah, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. Not every book is for everybody.
That's right. Are you working on a new book now? Can you tell us anything at all that might be coming up in the next few years?
You know, I wish that I could. I've been living in this other world for so long, and as we were talking about, this book is, you know, still feels really relevant to this moment, and for me, and I know for a lot of other writers, this political moment is somewhat paralyzing. And so I'm not really sure what the next thing will be, what world I'll be living in. It takes a big commitment for me to put 2 feet in another world.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I hope to be back to talk to you about it maybe in another five years.
I hope so, too. Give us a website, any kind of contact information.
Sure. Eleanor-Henderson.com is my website.
And you can reach Eleanor there. Okay, well, Eleanor Henderson, it has been such a pleasure to see you again, and your book was absolutely fabulous. Did not expect to be reading a book like this at this point in time, but thank you for that.
Thank you so much, Tish.
Again, I've been talking to Eleanor Henderson, author of The 12 Mile Straight. Go out and get it. Thank you, Eleanor. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.